When Harry Schultz invited me to speak at this conference on the Soviet threat to the free world, and by implication, to the investment prospects of all of you here present, he expressed some anxiety that in doing so, I might indulge in the traditional English habit of understatement. My intention this morning, and I fear at the cost of your peace of mind, is to allay his suspicion. After 1945, and under American leadership, a new international world order was created embracing the non-communist countries. This order is now disintegrating in military, political, and economic terms. This process of decline is not inevitable, but how to arrest it is the major problem facing the world today. The post-1945 order, which lasted, say, into the early 1970s, was based on the U.S. military nuclear deterrent. Trade liberalization, relatively stable rates of inflation, rising poverty, prosperity, and above all, confidence. The system was fundamentally powered by the dynamic U.S. economy and included, besides the U.S., Western Europe and Japan. After the late 1950s and into the early 1970s, there was an unquestioned reliance within this system on cheap Middle East oil as an energy source of prime importance. Let us look briefly at this system and its institutions and at the leading factors which have undermined it. We should then turn our attention to the major manifestations of the new Soviet threat to the U.S. as they have arisen in the 1970s. And finally, we'll try to highlight some of the differing problems facing the U.S. in Western Europe, the Middle East, and East Asia during the coming decade. Whatever our current prospects for the 1980s, the past 35 years have left an invaluable institutional legacy which should help us to face the new challenges of the 1980s. And these institutions were created by Western statesmen who felt that common dangers required a common solution, and who also felt that political will and determination were as important as any technical device or institution. In the economic sphere, the U.S. and U.K. governments created the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in 1944 to stabilize the free world currencies and achieve the maximum possible degree of trade or commercial policy liberalization. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, followed in 1947. And successive rounds of trade talks have led to ever greater liberalization of world trade. The problems of a war-devastated Western Europe led to the Marshall Plan of 1947, implemented by the Organization for European Economic Cooperation in 1948 and its successor, the OECD. The European Economic Community came into being 10 years later, and like the European Payments Union, was dedicated to trade liberalization on a regional basis. And it should be remembered in this context that the 30 years from 1945 to 1975 saw a greater increase of wealth and mutual prosperity in the West, including Japan, than in any other period in world history. Two factors were central to this phenomenon. During the 1950s and 1960s, Middle East oil cost about $2 to $3 a barrel. It now costs, and I haven't read the papers today, over $30. During the 1950s and 1960s, inflation in the U.S. and other leading Western industrial countries increased at an average annual rate of less than 5%. The world economy was thus in effect on a dollar standard from 1945 to August 1971, when President Nixon broke the link between gold and the dollar and floated the dollar. And today, in May 1980, U.S. inflation, I think, is near 20%. At such a time, we might do well to remember Lenin's remark, quoted by Keynes, that there is no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. In the the military sphere, the institutions I've described had a parallel, above all in the North Atlantic Treaty of 1949. This has remained a defensive keystone of the Western security system. It was followed by bilateral treaties between the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand, between the U.S. and Japan, and between the U.S. and the Philippines in 1951. And the Mideast Regional Pact of CENTO followed in 1954, and the Manila Pact, setting up CETO, was also signed in the same year. But it was the American nuclear missile superiority over the USSR that guaranteed the peace from 1945 onwards. This was the factor that underwrote the containment of communist expansionism. And with the weakening of this ascendancy came the decline of the Western security system. It was in the late 1960s that the USSR began swiftly to overtake the U.S. lead in nuclear strategic weapons. And by the mid-1970s, there was strategic parity between the two superpowers, despite the signing of the SALT I Treaty in 1972. And meanwhile, the USSR re-equipped its armed forces and developed a global navy. I'd like now to mention three particular aspects of the Soviet buildup in the conventional field and how they may affect developments in the 1980s. The first aspect of the ongoing Soviet military buildup in the conventional field concerns Eastern Europe. The overall Soviet troop strength in that area is now probably 35% above that of the combined NATO forces in Europe. The Soviet advantage in tanks is probably 3-1, in artillery 2.5-1, and in tactical aircraft 2.4-1. Most of the Soviet hardware and many of the 30 divisions in Eastern Europe are concentrated in East Germany. These large Russian forces are available for a massive thrust across the North German plain. Another 30-odd Soviet divisions are held in the western areas of the USSR proper, the Carpathians, Belorussia, and the Baltic states. And other Soviet forces in Hungary threaten both Romania and the integrity of Yugoslavia following the death of Marshal Tito. Although there are no Soviet troops stationed in Bulgaria, the Russians have developed a powerful car ferry system between the Black Sea port of Ilichevsk near Odessa and Varna, the Bulgarian port, some 400 miles south. And these car ferries are each able to carry 150 T-62 tanks. And in this way, the Soviets have developed the maximum possible way of applying pressure against Yugoslavia at some future time. A second aspect of the Soviet conventional build-up during the 1970s, and one which continues in full effect, is the dramatic expansion of the Soviet Navy from a coastal defense force to an oceanic blue water fleet, second only to the United States Navy. And this new Soviet Navy is concentrated along the vital sea lanes which sustain the West. The North Atlantic lifeline connecting the U.S. and Western Europe, the Cape Oil route from the Persian Gulf around the Cape of Good Hope, and the tanker routes from the same Persian Gulf to Japan. And in addition, Moscow deploys a submarine fleet, already estimated to be about 400 vessels, or 10 times the number possessed by Nazi Germany at the outbreak of the Second World War. Of the capabilities of the Soviet Navy in the next decade, there can be no doubt. It remains for the West to convince the USSR that in such vital areas as the Indian Ocean and the Far East, it is determined to defend its interests. A third aspect of the Soviet build-up at the beginning of the 1980s is represented by the 45 crack divisions massed on the Chinese northern borders. These are backed by SS-20 mobile nuclear missile systems based on the plains of the Mongolian People's Republic. And in addition, the Soviets are expanding their forces in the Kuril Islands, north of Japan, and are conducting frequent naval and air force exercises all around the Japanese home islands. Two immediate explanations exist for this massive buildup by land and sea. Should the present confrontation between Moscow and the West escalate into global war, then the Soviets intend to make this an all-arms conflict by land, sea, and air on a world basis. Adopting a more limited scenario, should the Soviets, at some time in the early 1980s, attempt to invade Iran or Pakistan or actively back a Soviet proxy coup in Saudi Arabia, and Western forces were to successfully intervene, bringing about a local defeat for the Russians, then the Kremlin might well decide to use its massive conventional forces in Europe to occupy part of West Germany, or Norway, say, with the object of trading off their gains by a negotiated truce in Iran or Pakistan. And in such a situation, the West would have to negotiate. And the lesson from this, that the present Soviet strength in conventional forces alone provides them with a strategic bargaining counter wherever their policy requires, and that the only way the West can regain the initiative is by counterforce, the only factor in world politics the Kremlin cannot ignore. We must remember that in the Soviet view, strategic nuclear power is the power base from which all other relationships flow. And this affects all negotiations between East and West. And despite all the West's economic difficulties, Soviet ideology and Soviet economic model become less and less applicable to the West, as well as to the Third World. And hence, the increasing militarization of Soviet policy, a trend that will continue, at any rate, for the foreseeable future. Nor can one wonder that with their military strength, their knowledge of the West's economic difficulties, and their advances in Africa, the Middle East, and Afghanistan, the Soviets face the 1980s with some confidence. Looking at the individual theaters under threat, the most important strategic consideration we have to face in the defense of Western Europe during the next 3 to 4 years is that in the event of a conventional Russian attack or a Russian attack using theater nuclear weapons, there is no longer any certainty of an American strategic response. The pattern of inevitable escalation as the U.S. response can no longer be taken for granted. And this is what military and strategic analysts call strategic disconnection. Now, I don't intend to go into a discussion of first strike capabilities or strategic nuclear systems. You'll be listening on this subject to Air Marshal Manol, a formidable exponent of these matters, a man with an encyclopedic range of knowledge. I will confine myself to a brief tour of America's 4 major European allies with some remarks on the Middle East, Southwest, and Northeast Asia, and China. My own country, having suffered for many years from cumulative collectivist trends has economic problems that will not be solved overnight. Our recovery depends on a reduction of government spending and a reassertion of fiscal and monetary orthodoxy. But I hope it will be apparent that the policies of the present government could lead to a recovery of national morale and a resurgence of economic power over the coming decade. Certainly, we are deeply aware of the Soviet ambitions in Europe. And although it is not generally realized abroad, Britain's defense posture is a relatively formidable one. As regards France, there the long-term strategic problem is a conjunction of Gaullism and the influence of the French Communist Party. It will also be remembered that since 1965, France has not participated in the working of the Atlantic Alliance military organization SHAPE. And these factors have to be taken into account in any assessment of France's strategic role in the next decade. And more important still is the belief shared by the Soviets that they can manipulate to their advantage France's professed policy of remaining independent of the United States. Unlike the French Communist Party, the Italian Communist Party claims to follow the Eurocommunist course. But the party, which gathered some 30% of the total votes in the 1979 elections, also still claims to be a Marxist-Leninist party and supports, in general, Moscow's foreign policy. And given that NATO's southern headquarters is in Naples, the Italian situation needs close surveillance by U.S. policymakers. But the Italian will to freedom has survived many vicissitudes since 1945, and in the military context, it must be said that the Italians have loyally agreed to install 112 of NATO's new ground-launched cruise missiles in the program agreed by the alliance in December 1979. Now, West Germany must be said to be America's most dependable continental ally, with its dynamic economy and efficient armed forces. At the same time, it has to be recognized that she still supports the concept of détente in Europe or Ostpolitik. And also her trading links with the Soviet Union amount to some 4 to 5 times the value of Britain's.
Can I come in on that point, Michael? I think this is something that people don't realize the importance of. Not only does it help the enemy when we trade with them, but it also makes us so dependent on that trade, in this case Germany, so that if we try to withdraw, it hurts so many individuals, it starts unemployment, and you get opposition within the country, so it defeats us in both ways to do that sort of trading. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right, I agree entirely. Yes, entirely. And it also, I would add to that, that it is as well to remember that she imports very large quantities of natural gas from the Soviet bloc. For all that, she remains a bastion of NATO, even though, judged by her reaction to the Afghan crisis and the U.S.-Iranian confrontation over the Tehran hostages, there are circumstances when Bonn can be a reluctant ally. We now turn to the most sensitive and most critical strategic theater at the opening of the 1980s, the Middle East and Southwest Asia. Here, U.S. policy faces the gravest challenge of the next decade. It is paradoxical that the present deadlock over the Palestine issue continues to alienate Muslim states, potentially strong natural allies of the U.S., since it is a well-known fact that Islam is inherently hostile to Soviet communism. With the collapse of Iran went the pillar of containment policies in the area. And there can be little doubt that but for the fall of the Shah, the Russians would not have invaded Afghanistan. Unlike Central Europe and Northeast Asia, it's important in a global context to note that there is no demarcation line between the Soviet Union and Western interests in the Middle East. And this affords the Soviets considerable license. Already she has a strong presence in the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, Aden, where she threatens the pro-Western sheikhdom of Oman, which guards the Straits of Hormuz at the bottleneck of the Persian Gulf. And this presence marks the southern pincers of the Russian movement against the Gulf, just as the massive Soviet forces in Afghanistan represents the northern arm of this pincer movement. From Afghanistan, the Russian forces are only 300 miles from the Straits of Hormuz, through which pass over 60% of West Europe's oil and 85% of Japan's. How critical the situation in this area is may be judged when we remember that at their narrowest point, the straits are only 24 miles wide. The region generally is riven with social, political, and religious tensions. The Gulf oil is vital to the West, and Soviet military concentration in the area is compounded by the West's military weakness. As matters stand at this time, there can be no question that the regional balance of forces both in the Middle East and in Southwest Asia favors the Soviet Union. And in this situation, no plans exist to deploy large Western forces in the region. Instead, it is intended that the Russians should be deterred by the naval and amphibious forces provided by the United States during the decade to come. They will operate in the northern Indian Ocean. But how effective is this going to be? Not until after 1983 will American pre-positioned amphibious forces be available for the Indian Ocean region. It is true that special landing ships have been designed and are being built by the U.S. Navy. But again, the lead time on such construction projects is 3 to 5 years. Special cargo aircraft for these amphibious forces, enabling standby forces in the U.S. to be flown to the region, are also being developed. But long-term Western interests are dependent on pre-positioned forces. And time is the essence of the problem. And on top of this, there is no proper base structure from which to deploy naval and air forces. Modern amphibious forces and aircraft carriers need large modern bases with an industrial infrastructure. In the Western Europe theater, and in the Western Pacific, such bases exist for the servicing and supply of the U.S. Navy. But, despite the building of an American air and naval facility at Diego Garcia, 2,200 miles from the Straits of Hormuz, and plans to develop other facilities at Berbera in Somaliland and Mombasa in Kenya, no large base will be built in the region in the foreseeable future. The American carriers at present on station in the Persian Gulf are in fact serviced from Pearl Harbor or Subic Bay in the Philippines. And even Subic Bay is 6,000 miles from the Persian Gulf. The U.S. Navy certainly faces grave problems in the long term, to say nothing of the short term, in defending the vital Persian Gulf region. In the meantime, what is the threat to this region from the Soviets? A Soviet conventional invasion cannot be ruled out, but the Soviets are cautious by nature, and such an attack would carry grave risks. Moscow could never be certain that the West would not resort to arms in defense of its vital oil supplies, and there would be the risk of a major escalation in Europe. And what seems rather more likely is Soviet-inspired subversion in the region, especially in Saudi Arabia, involving pro-Soviet local forces, Soviet proxy forces such as the Cubans, and strong Russian logistic, air, and naval support deployed from, say, Aden. And such tactics would be much more difficult to resist. Experience has taught us how dangerously easily subversion can provide a spurious legitimacy for Soviet intervention in a thinly disguised form. The Middle East challenge will not go away. It will intensify, and it must be defended at all costs. In Northeast Asia, the situation is currently less serious, but potentially almost as dangerous as the Middle East. In the face of Soviet expansionism in this area, and Vietnam's close alliance with Moscow, Japan and South Korea are greatly reliant on their security treaties with the U.S. And on these security guarantees depend American trading and political influence in these countries. And furthermore, if Japan and South Korea were to fall under Soviet domination, the American defense perimeter in the Western Pacific would be pushed back inevitably to Pearl Harbor. And the addition of Japan's vast industrial resources to the Soviet empire would be an acquisition second only to that of Western Europe. And only vigilance and determination on the part of the U.S. will preserve the balance of power in Northeast Asia in the next decade. The prospects for the tentative alliance between America and China are particularly difficult to evaluate. The overall dynamics of the relationship is a strategic one. The U.S. needs China as she needs Europe and Japan, and as each needs the other as a mutual bulwark against Soviet expansionism. In theory, economic prospects are good, given the vast extent of the China market. But Chinese poverty and bureaucracy will mitigate against the sort of economic takeoff that regenerated Japan in the 1950s and South Korea in the 1960s. And there can be little doubt that with an eye to the Soviets, Peking's approach to the relationship will be solely from the perspective of its ongoing geopolitical conflict with its giant neighbor.
Michael, would you agree that we should look at China as only an expedient ally and not one that we can really trust?
Well, I would. I think it was Harold Macmillan who said that alliances were inspired by fear and not by love.
Right.
I also think one must remember that historically the Chinese are a very independent people. And thirdly, I think we must always have in mind the nightmare possibility that one day, and I don't believe there will, but one day, there could be a reconciliation between Moscow and Peking, and then God help us all. Now, however this may be, that is to say, our attitude, the basis of our relationship with China. However this may be, so flagrant is Soviet military expansionism that every effort must be made to develop good relations with Peking. Perceived American influence in China will become an important factor in Moscow's calculations. and Sino-American friendship can become an important stabilizing factor in the troubled world of the 1980s. Now, finally, what conclusions are to be drawn from this increasingly hazardous confrontation with the Soviets? In the first place, the Soviets have some serious problems of their own. And this offers no grounds for complacency on our part. But it is as well to know your enemy's weaknesses so that you may aim to exploit them. Russia's agricultural sector is so weak that despite possessing vast areas of some of the best farmland in the world, it has to import large quantities of grain from the West. Its industrial production is stagnant, the result of the intellectual inertia of the communist system compounded by bureaucratic interference of a degree that can hardly be imagined in the West. And there is an increasing questioning of the Soviet system by some of its best minds, as the ordeal of Dr. Sakharov shows. And in addition, the Soviets face a major energy crisis of their own. As the cost of extracting the frozen oil reserves of Siberia mount month by month. Having said this, however, it should not be overlooked that in these very problems and internal contradictions, the Soviet leaders see an increasingly attractive solution in a forward military policy of revolution and expansionism. This is the challenge of the 1980s, made all the more threatening by virtue of the vacillation, weakness, and disunity of the West at the present time. The U.S. task over the coming decade is the maintenance of the strategic balance of power. The U.S. economy still underwrites the free world economy, and only with a successful and expanding free economy can the free world order be maintained, and with it the free institutions. But strategic considerations come first, and with it the will to exercise power and the perception of this will for all to see. Sir Robert Thompson, one of the council members of my institute, once defined national power as manpower plus applied resources times will. And the failure to exert this will could well end in a situation of nuclear coercion, which directed at the United States could spell the end of us all. And yet I'm reminded of Winston Churchill's reflection on the day of the Pearl Harbor attack, when the strategic picture for the West was very daunting indeed. And Churchill remembered the words of Lord Grey about the power of the American people. Once the fire is lighted under it, there is no limit to the power it can generate.